We know the impacts of the climate crisis largely fall on those who contribute the least to it, Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. We also know that we need to reach net zero carbon emissions fast. The time is now for courageous business leadership to help create a future that serves people, especially those most vulnerable, and the planet. Hi, I'm Isaac Graves, and this week on the Just and Sustainable Economy podcast, we have two conversations on these very issues that will identify tangible actions that both businesses and individuals can do to address the devastating impacts of climate change on our communities and biosphere by putting people and equity at the center. Before we dive into the episode, I invite you to participate in ASBN's current policy and advocacy work by joining our Climate and Energy Working Group. To join, email the Director of Climate and Energy Policy, Michael Green, at mgreen@asbnetwork.org to learn more. Today is our first conversation in the series, Climate and Racial Justice, the Nexus of the Next Economy, with Ibrahim Al-Husseini, Full Cycle, Chichesca Martinez, Artist and Climate Organizer, and Donnell Baird, Block Power, moderated by Sunga Zhang, ASBN's Board Co-Chair and CEO of Empowered. Sunga?
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Sunga Zhang. I'm the SVC chair, and I'm also the CEO of Empowered. So I'll briefly introduce myself, and then I'd love to turn it over to my fellow panelists for them to introduce themselves as well. So as the CEO of Empowered, Empowered is a B Corp and a benefit corporation. We design, distribute, and sell solar lights, portable solar lights all around the world, both in developed markets where people use our products for camping, hiking, et cetera, and then also in emerging markets where there are up to 3 billion people without consistent access to electricity. So we've been able to affect over 4 million lives and avert 2.5 million tons of carbon dioxide through our work. In emerging markets, we deploy primarily through NGO partners. So we have over 700 NGO partners. And we also are very active in disaster situations whereby light, water, and power are the primary needs that are needed right after an emergency. So I'm so pleased to be here today with a number of outstanding panelists. And I will turn it over to you, Ibrahim Al-Husseini from Full Cycle. If you could share a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to your current work in the world, that would be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Sunga. Good morning, everybody. I'm Ibrahim Al-Husseini. Good to be with you all. I immigrated to the U.S. in the early 90s for a college education and fell in love with the U.S. and decided to stay and built my first enterprise out of my college dorm room and became a serial entrepreneur and a technology investor. And I eventually became a climate investor back in 2003 because I noticed the degradation of the quality of the marine life firsthand by going back and visiting my parents over in the Red Sea and seeing what happened to my favorite spot over a decade from going from being completely lush and full of life to being desolate, barren, full of plastic. And it broke my heart. And I basically turned my home into climate university between July and December of 2003 and gave, you know, and understood the chemical balance on this planet more. And since then I've been a clean tech investor and, in 2003, I launched my first Full Cycle fund, and you know, we developed a model. We basically purpose-built a model to accelerate the deployment of climate-critical technologies. The reason being is because it's a, you know, obviously climate change is a race against time, and most people don't realize that the discrepancy between the carbon math on the planet has much more to do with the underpinnings of modern civilization, like the systems that run, you know, human civilization, water, energy, transportation, food, waste systems. So we developed a model that, you know, quickly transitions us from the old 19th and 20th century technology that was never designed with climate change in mind to their 21st century counterparts. And obviously we'll be doing that for decades to come. And it's very, very math-oriented business model that boils things down, literally down to the global warming potential to every molecule. And maybe we can spend some time talking about that later. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Next, I'd like to introduce Shutescat Martinez. He's an artist and climate organizer. So same question to you. Can you share a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to do the work that you do?
Good morning, y'all. My name is Shutescat. I'm an artist. Grew up in the climate and environmental justice organizing space. Have been doing that work for a long time. And my people are the Mexica peoples. My family's from Xochimilco, from Mexico City. Grateful to be a part of this. A lot of my work has grown and evolved and changed over the years. And I think the last year has kind of pushed us all in the climate space, in the environmental space, to continue to understand and dig deep into being rooted in the intersections between our movements and other social movements. And so I think that, yeah, a lot of my focus and the work that I do through my art, through my advocacy work, lands at the intersection of indigenous sovereignty and climate justice. I think being a proponent for the significance and pushing for the conversation to expand around how critical it is for indigenous liberation to be, you know, a key part of addressing the climate crisis, and in restoring and returning lands to stewardship of indigenous peoples as a framework and an alternative social and political reality that can help usher in a future that is truly rooted in a just and balanced relationship between humanity and the land. So grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And our third panelist, Donnell Baird, may be joining us a bit late. So we will get started. And when he joins us, we'll have him introduce himself. So my first question to my two fellow panelists is, what is your approach to tackling climate change?
Would you like me to go?
Sure.
Okay, great. So I mentioned earlier this strategy that we developed at Full Cycle. And I think it's super interesting to share because it also gives us a little bit of a reality for how private capital can actually play its part in combating the climate crisis. So one of the things that we did, first of all, is I mentioned that climate change is really a discrepancy between what modern civilization produces in greenhouse gas emissions and what the Earth can absorb. And the discrepancy is about 52 gigatons a year, which is a gigaton is about 400,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of gas. Not that that helps anybody visualize it, but it's a lot. So we only pick technologies that we invest in that can abate a minimum of one of those 52 gigatons. We found some that can abate up to four of those gigatons on an annual basis at full deployment, which is a big deal. But that's the scale that we operate on, because anything below that is unfortunately not going to move the needle in the time frame that we have, which is a very condensed one. The second thing we do is we don't invest in early stage technologies. Not because we don't need to invest in innovation. We always have to invest in innovation. It's just that it doesn't meet climate timelines, right? If your house is already on fire, if the fire is already in your backyard, you don't go invent firefighting technology. You accelerate the deployment of buckets and hoses. So that's another thing that we do, is we only invest in market-ready technology without technology risk. This allows us to break ground on projects worldwide. And the third thing we do is we actually don't just invest in the equity of the companies, because even though that helps them grow, it doesn't condense the timeline of which they do a global rollout, which is one of the biggest problems that clean tech companies that come with high CapEx at the project level face, is how do we, you know, once you transition out of kind of the venture funding, how do you take these technologies and then roll them out globally? Well, you need special funding vehicles that allows them to do that. And we spend 85% of our capital actually on these real assets and not just on the corporate equity of the companies to become a dedicated funding vehicle for their projects, such that they go from an aspiring technology to, let's say, the promising 900-pound gorilla in that vertical, replacing their 20th century counterpart as fast as possible. Because if we don't take into account the timeline of which these technologies are going to roll out, we might as well go invest in the next dating app, because it's not going to move the needle on climate change. So we call ourselves unapologetically pragmatic about our approach. And of course, we do it in a risk-adjusted return profile such that we're producing asymmetrical returns to investors. So they're getting primarily real asset risk, but with growth equity returns. And the reason why we focus on that is because we need to be able to aggregate a lot of capital. And unless we make it really easy for asset allocators to allocate to us, you know, we're not going to also raise enough capital to move the needle. So that's part of the strategy of how we find ourselves to be pragmatic at addressing the problem.
Thank you so much, Ibrahim. I'm going to cut over for a second and have Donnell Baird introduce himself. So Donnell, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to do the work that you're doing?
Great. Hi, everybody. My name is Donnell Baird. I started a climate tech company called Block Power. We focus on analyzing, financing, and installing clean energy equipment in buildings. We are moving urban low-income buildings 100% off of fossil fuels. I'm calling it, we're turning the buildings into Teslas. Just like you take the fossil fuel engine out of an automobile, there now is existing hardware that allows us to take fossil fuel equipment out of buildings and replace it with 100% electric, smart, modern equipment that can run on 100% electricity from wind or solar, local battery storage. And so we are analyzing, financing, and installing that equipment in urban buildings all over the country, coast to coast. We have products in LA, in Oakland, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Chicago, through the upper Midwest over to New York City, where we've completed energy efficiency and solar upgrades in 1,100 low-income apartment buildings, leveraging government capital as well as private sector capital. Recently raised a round of financing from Goldman Sachs to invest $50 million in moving urban buildings off of fossil fuels. And, you know, all with the goal of creating jobs, tech-enabled green construction jobs for low-income people, vulnerable populations like ex-offenders or people who age out of foster care, and are looking to expand that model all over the country. Super excited that the Biden-Harris team has announced their commitment to electrify 2 million buildings. And so we're working closely with them on that and really looking to resolve our portion. You know, we're not smart enough like Ibrahim to invest all across different parts of the economy. But for the building sector, we know that buildings across the United States are responsible for 30 to 40% of greenhouse gas emissions. And we now have existing technology to take those greenhouse gas emissions down to damn near zero. So we fully intend to do that. Other people can work in transportation or agriculture or industry to handle those emissions from those sectors. But we fully intend to analyze and finance and electrify 100 million buildings over the next, you know, five to 10 years. Thanks. Glad to be here with all of you today. I'm also like testifying to Congress. So I'm like a little in and out. If they ask me a question, I'll have to flip back to Congress. But glad to be here with you. Josh Mailman is a friend. Always super excited to be here with the SVN community.
Well, we're delighted to have you, and that's a great excuse. So we'll accommodate you as you go back and forth. I'd love to turn the question over to Shu Tescott. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, how you tackle climate change?
For sure. Yeah, and I think less of a like an individual work is more. I think ideologically, I see it as, you know, so much of the work being done to address the climate crisis comes from this place of reproducing a scenario in which we can continue to operate within the existing, you know, framework of our relationship to land, to resources, to community, to people. And I think that challenging the very relationship that we have, that has, you know, created this crisis, I think is incredibly important. I think innovation of technology is absolutely critical. And that's where, you know, Ibrahim and Donnell like are really, you know, doing that work. And at the same time, I think, there's a very significant element of addressing the climate crisis that I think must be grounded in us really challenging, our societal kind of approach and awareness and understanding of what it is that this climate crisis means for us. And I think less than a significant issue or a problem or a challenge, it's a symptom, I think, of something great that is actually bigger than just the climate crisis. And I think that, you know, for me, a lot of what I have looked at and understood and from a community perspective is how the climate crisis is just a continuation of this legacy of colonialism, of the exploitation of land, of the removal of indigenous people, of the enslavement of African people. Is like that whole legacy that has kind of laid the foundation and the groundwork for the existence of this country, the growth of the wealth of this nation, the exploitation of other nations, the endless wars that have been waged overseas. Like those are all things that have been birthed out of the same approach to capital, to growth of an economy, to the upholding of an economy and an economic model and framework that has now borne fruit to the climate crisis, which is the most existential umbrella that I think encases and connects every other societal community issue that our people are experiencing, whether it is access to housing, clean food, water. And so I think, you know, it's those larger conversations that I try to kind of push the envelope on through my art, through, you know, my platform. And I think that holds a lot of weight, because when we transition into a fossil free future, when we transition away from these archaic systems of powering our world, our cities, our communities, how do we do it in a way that doesn't duplicate these same systems that have historically oppressed Black, brown, and indigenous peoples, poor peoples, that have exploited and functioned off of the abandonment of many of our communities, the desolation of many countries outside of the United States for the continued accumulation of wealth for, you know, small percentages of corporate CEOs, whether they hang the banner of coal and oil or renewable energy. So it's like, I think it's bigger than just an energy problem. It's bigger than just a carbon issue. It's bigger than just a fossil fuel issue. For me, I think it's a relational issue. It's like, how do we transform our relationship to one another? And I think fundamentally, if you look back at what this crisis has been and our relationship to this crisis has been, I think it goes back to our relationship to land. And that was the driving factor for so much of the violence that took place here in the United States, which is a lot of the perspective that I hold. And so, you know, moving through that, I think indigenous leadership has continued to show us potentials for alternative futures in which, you know, indigenous communities make up such a small percentage of the world's population, but protect 80% of the world's biodiversity. So that's like a fact that I see people kind of circulating recently. But I think it's perfectly shows how significant it is to also in these moments understand how do we return stewardship to indigenous communities, to indigenous leaders. How do we ensure that the transition towards an equitable and just future that addresses the climate crisis really uplifts and empowers frontline communities, poor working class people, Black and brown and indigenous people, not just enriching, you know, the CEOs of these companies that are investing in renewable energy solutions. So I think it's a really, you know, tricky way in which we navigate that future. And I guess I'm just always a proponent for like kind of the community approach, because that's what I know and that's what I came up doing. And that's not to invalidate, you know, other people's work who are experts in other fields, but that's just like the position that I hold and what I will continue to push for, because I trust and I know that people like Donnell and other folks and Ibrahim are out there doing the work kind of at a more technological level. And again, both are absolutely critical. There's the very mathematical, technological element of it that, you know, I can't address on my own, or community on their own necessarily won't be able to do. So it's like, I think that this melding of cultural transformation and technological transformation. And I think one will fail without the other, and vice versa.
Thank you so much for that. You led very naturally into my second question, which was going to be about the intersection of climate change and racial justice, and how critical it is to really understand the connections between the two. So I'd love to turn it over to my other panelists to kind of delve further into that question and how your work really tackles the intersection of the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was said was incredibly powerful. I'd just love to continue to expand on it. So thank you for that. You know, there's this idea that we can technology our way out of this, or capitalism our way out of this, and we absolutely can't. And even now that we've discovered some breakthrough technologies that actually can, like right now today, we have the technology to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across America by 30%. Like all of that stuff exists today. We probably could reduce it by 50%. With existing technology today, right? The problem isn't technological. The problem is one of trust and community, in that so many people in this country have great reasons to not trust new technologies or new financial products. So you have to get someone to trust you in order to have them open up their home and their community and embrace your new technology. If you're going to switch someone from burning oil or gas in their home, and you're going to come in and put in an all electric system, that all electric system exists today, but that homeowner needs to trust you in order to trust that that all electric system is going to take care of them and their family for the next 20 years. That is the problem that we're facing now, is the problem of trust and community. In the business world, we'll call it distribution and customer acquisition costs. But fundamentally, it comes down to this question of, you know, can we trust one another so that we can begin to distribute and embrace the new technologies that are going to transition us from an entirely fossil fuel economy to an all electric economy? And as part of our work at Block Power, one of the things we've been learning, I joined the board of the Sierra Club. I'm also on the board of the Sunrise Movement and of the Climate Reality Project. And just to be blunt, because I think the climate crisis demands that we are blunt, Sierra Club and Sunrise Movement have tremendous racial divisions inside their organizations, right? I mean, as environmental, old school, old, you know, people, environmentalists, and new, younger generations of climate activists have tremendous racial divisions internally. And this idea that, you know, we're going to respond to the climate crisis, and oh, as a part of that, we need to be thoughtful about how we include diversity and economic empowerment as a part. I mean, in what world are we going to have a solution to transforming the global economy that isn't dependent on diversity and inclusion? There's just no way to do it. There's just no way to sell enough technology and install technology in enough buildings or cars or whatever to transform the economy without Black and brown and low-income white people not being some secondary afterthought, but central to that. And to the extent that we can have leadership from our indigenous brothers and sisters and colleagues and communities that can help us make long-term recalibrations of the way that we think about relationships to resources, I think it's central. It's not an afterthought. There just simply is no other path to resolving climate change other than a path that is centering diversity and economic inclusion.
Thank you. Ibrahim, would you like to, Heems, excuse me, would you like to answer the same question?
Sure. So I grew up, my parents are political refugees, pretty much. You know, our heritage is Palestinian. So, you know, they were forced to flee what is now Israel. And so I grew up as a second class citizen in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, felt firsthand what it's like to have a you know, a precarious, unstable upbringing and have a arbitrary prejudice that has nothing to do with, you know, my ability to contribute or not contribute to my community, city, country, world. So the other side of the coin of that is when one grows up, you know, just like people in North America have grown up, at least, you know, the BIPOC community has grown up in North America. There's a, that the other side of that coin is it gives us a sensitivity to see the world without the blinders of privilege. So we get, you know, the advantages to see things holistically because we all live in this closed sphere in the middle of space, right? Like there's a very delicate life support system that makes this planet be able to sustain life. And, you know, there, you know, all of the adversity gives us these lenses to look at the ripples that get created from making decisions at one level and how they affect the whole. I look at that, you know, I look at every curse also as a gift. So when you see this panel made up of, you know, African Americans, you know, Muslim immigrants, Koreans, Native Americans, you're looking at the future mosaic that makes diversity stronger around the world, where we're all coming together and rowing in the same direction. And that, of course, allows us to all contribute our gifts to solving this crisis. You know, COVID also helped us understand the inextricable connectivity of everything, right? There is no lane for healthcare, lane for economy, lane for social justice, lane for climate change. Everything is interconnected. You know, one person coughs halfway across the world, the whole economy shuts down. So this is a great moment for humanity where we can shed some of these legacy ways of which we've operated in the past, where it's we're extracting for our benefit at the expense of the whole, because we finally now understand that there is no winners in that equation. Again, we all live in the same closed sphere in the middle of space. There's no planet B, there's nowhere else to go. There's no air quality and water quality and food quality and social justice stability that somehow knows borders. It doesn't exist. They don't have passports. They don't stop at a border and get turned away. All of it is interconnected. And there's the same thing with climate change. The emissions from one nation affect the temperature in every nation. So we're now finally there. And we just have to make sure, as my colleagues have said, to upgrade our culture globally so we all understand that. And I'm glad that with all the pain and blood and awful things that have happened in North America, we are starting to lead in that area. And this panel, the mix of this panel is to me a window into how we are changing as a nation.
Thank you so much. And before going on to the next question, I'd like to jump in and answer on behalf of Empower. So I neglected to talk a little bit about my background, but I was born in Korea when it was not yet a tiger economy. So I didn't have running water or electricity in the home in which I grew up. So it's sort of feels like a full circle moment to be the CEO of a company that has a business model whereby our solar lights are distributed not only to those, you know, who use them for recreational uses, but also to those who don't have access to electricity. And when it comes to natural disasters, we found again and again, those communities that are affected the most that don't have access to water, light, and power are those in communities that are generally low-income communities that don't have the political voice, whatever it may be. You know, we were very prolific in Puerto Rico in 2017 after Hurricane Maria. We distributed over 80,000 solar lights with mobile charging technology so that people could communicate, so that they could light their homes, so that they could, you know, carry on with their daily lives, because it took over a year for many regions within Puerto Rico to receive electricity. So in some senses, for us, for myself, for the work that we do, there is such power in business to be able to take critical resource needs and bring them to the people who need them. And we do that in a way where we know that everyone deserves access to something as simple as light. And we know that sometimes the infrastructure that countries have in place are not adequate to meet the needs of their citizens. And the same thing happens here in the US. We've been, you know, on site for many natural disasters. And then just day to day, there are many indigenous communities, communities of low income, whereby people use solar lights because they can't afford electricity. So I do think that it's critical, this intersection, because as Shutescott said, it's systematic. It's about access. And we need to dismantle it brick by brick. So my next question to all of you is, what has been your greatest success in the work that you've been doing? And what has been one of the greatest challenges? Whoever wants to jump in first.
I can speak to an interesting one that has come up. And one thing I said I was going to mention, this is probably, you know, an okay time to mention that is, you know, so we focus as a fund, again, on molecules, right? Like there's, you know, most people talk a lot about CO2 emissions. By the way, for those of you who don't realize that, you know, Donnell's work is very critical. Building efficiency is one of the biggest contributors to climate change in the world. Sometimes we're always looking at like Star Trek-y type things to come and save us, the silver bullet technologies, when it really is a lot of these very simple technologies. Not to, using the word simple doesn't mean easy. I know that work is very hard, Donnell, what you're doing, but I just want to acknowledge that. So we focus a lot on CO2 emissions, but actually CO2 is the weakest greenhouse gas, right? Like the other greenhouse gases are much more potent. They're hundreds and thousands of times more heat trapping. They actually make up, you know, and by some estimates, 1%, by some estimates, 24%, depending on if you're talking about global warming potential or volume of greenhouse gas emissions, but they're responsible for close to 50% of the warming. So we get a lot more climate bang for the buck when we focus on those for the next 20 years. And you know, like, so, and then, so, like I said earlier, raising capital for these types of things, you know, makes a lot of sense, right? On every level, economically, commercially, climate-wise. But one of the problems that I noticed is twofold. Number one, there's a cultural problem in the sense that, you know, people like us, you know, like people with the names Ibrahim al-Husseini are, we also get, we get another layer of scrutiny because of that. Like just another, like, you know, like I wasn't part of any sort of boys club, or I didn't go in, you know, like I don't play golf. I don't, you know, my name is a Muslim name. You know, there's even somebody from a very big commercial institution told one of my female partners, like, gosh, you know, what is it like, you know, to live, you know, to have a CEO who's, you know, who's a, I don't know, I don't want to put words in her mouth. It's like a misogynist. And she was like, wow, what would make you say that? And she's like, well, you know, he's a Muslim Arab. Like, what, you know, isn't that universally understood? And like, we all like, and, you know, and that's nothing to do with me. Thankfully, my female colleague was able to correct that perception. But we all live with these prejudices, and they make us so inefficient because we're just trying to do work. We're trying to do good work in the world, and we all have to deal with these, you know, unconscious biases, and they really make our economy and our solutions less efficient. So the human factor unfortunately, is an impediment, the cultural factor that we have to just upgrade our software already and be done with all this old legacy programming that is not serving us, is hurting us on so many levels. So, my call out is for everybody to, to check themselves and see if we are actually evaluating our choices based on, the data and flatly, or are we adding our, even liking someone is a prejudice. It's based on what we think likability is or isn't compared to what is making us efficient and allow us to solve the problems that we're trying to solve. So, it's just, again, an invitation for all of us to see each other beyond all of these labels and beyond all of these legacy cultural stereotypes that, make us Black or a woman or an Indigenous person or a Muslim or an Arab or whatever it may be. So we can just, again, be human beings who are all rowing in the same directions to try to solve these existential crises that we all face, no matter the color of our skin or our name or our religion or our sexual identity.
Thank you. Would either of my other two fellow panelists like to weigh in? Biggest successes, biggest challenges in the space?
Oh, we can't speak to success. We have a long way to go in terms of mitigating climate change. There's a whole lot of work to do. And we just look forward to finding great partners like the folks on this panel and who are part of this community to try and do the very great work that is necessary to achieve the long-term goals of preserving the habitability of this planet for our kids and grandkids.
Yeah, I'm with that.
Nice. Okay. So moving on to thinking about the path forward. So next week will mark the first 100 days of the Biden administration. And many would say that the administration has brought forth some substantial changes versus the prior administration, especially with respect to the inequitable impact of climate change on low-income communities. Going forward, are there any policies that you would champion in this space of work that we're all in to help us push forward in a more just and equitable manner? So any thoughts on, what our administration can focus on to help us, in our path forward?
Sure.
Go ahead, Danielle, please.
So one of the things that I'm talking about to Congress today and tomorrow is I believe communities of color, low-income white communities, Native communities, Black American communities, we need to own an economic stake in the smart green infrastructure that's being installed in our communities and across our country. If trillions of dollars of infrastructure, solar, battery, energy efficiency, electrification of buildings, electric charging, electric vehicle manufacturing, if all of that infrastructure is going to be built, Wi-Fi, wireless broadband, internet systems, if we're going to invest in creating all of that, then low-income communities and communities of color need to own a share of the economics of that. And I think that not only does it build trust, it also helps to address some of the legacies of historic disenfranchisement and inequality in this country, to allocate those equity ownership stakes to low-income communities. But it also creates a new kind of governance model that allows our communities to be at the forefront of influencing and governing decisions around the kinds of clean energy infrastructure and internet infrastructure that will be installed in our communities so that we are a full participant and avoid the kind of top-down extractive models of the past. We don't want to replace a fossil fuel extractive capitalist mechanism with a clean energy capitalist extractive mechanism. We have to be more collaborative and community oriented in terms of who gets to own and govern and maintain the new infrastructure. And so we were delighted to see that the White House Biden plan actually contains a significant amount of funding for these community ownership concepts. And one of the things that we're working on now is, I didn't realize that the big cable companies were gonna pay attention to this. And so we have to hire a bunch of lobbyists and fight the DC fight to preserve these community ownership policies and opportunities in the Congressional Infrastructure Plan. But hopefully we'll prevail, and hopefully we'll be able to use the Biden infrastructure plan to, invest in billions and billions of dollars worth of infrastructure assets that are owned by low-income communities in America.
For those of you who haven't read the America's Jobs Act, I found it to be a brilliant piece of legislation that actually helps America solve a lot of its problems, as you know, to the extent that government can play its role, as well as get us ready for the 21st century. You know, there's a lot of very thoughtful pieces of that legislation that are, are being unnecessarily minimized, because if that piece of legislation actually doesn't pass, America will become less competitive in the 21st century. It literally is about getting us as a country ready for a low carbon economy, which is part of all the growth sectors that are going to happen in the world. There's certain technological shifts that are going to happen, whether it's 5G, AI, I'm sure other big markets that are going to dominate the global economy. One of them is going to be low carbon infrastructure. So if we're not ready for that, we're going to become less and less relevant actually as an economic power in the world. So that piece of legislation is really thought it through broadly, including, massive job training, including rehiring people from the oil and gas sector to plug all the methane leaks that we have millions of abandoned wells that are still emitting methane. And methane actually is 86 times more heat trapping than CO2 in the first 20 years of the molecule's existence. That work is going to result in decades of high paying jobs for anybody who loses their job from the oil and gas sector. Plus, anybody else is going to be retrained with $186 billion to get ready for the future green jobs of tomorrow that are going to be not just high paying, but also resilient. So they're not going to be replaced by robotics and AI, just like a lot of other jobs might be. So interestingly enough, that there's this idea of the clean economy or the green economy being some sort of socialist regressive policy. In fact, it is one of the key pieces of what's going to keep us economically competitive in the 21st century. And without it, we are going to fall even further back to other nations that maybe don't hold rule of law as high as we do, human rights as high as we do, even with our track record being what it is. There's many other nations that are going to leap forward technologically ahead of us that don't hold these values as high as we do, which is changes the whole culture of the planet and the power balance here. So, I really hope this gets passed, and I hope it gets passed without a lot of, shenanigans around dilution here and there and the other. Anyway, I'm very impressed with this administration and so glad we got rid of the last one. That was a very, very scary time.
The only thing that I would add is just really looking at so many of kind of frontline Indigenous liberation struggles that have happened over the last decade, and how little Democratic administrations, whether it was the Obama administration or now the Biden administration, how much there was just a failure to show up and to help defend land for Indigenous peoples and to help do the right thing by stopping these pipelines from being placed through traditional sacred ancestral territory underneath clean water supply for millions of peoples, whether it's the Dakota Access Pipeline being built under the Missouri River. You know, like, Biden was VP, like, when that struggle was on the ground, you know, for like over a year. And the Obama administration did very little. And you know, I don't remember Biden ever really saying anything about it back then. And now we're seeing that he has again failed to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from being built, now that, you know, there have already been spills that have contaminated clean drinking water since oil began to flow in 2017. You know, and I think that the Keystone XL pipeline, obviously that was a win, but it's so kind of disheartening to see how fragile even some of these executive orders are, you know, where one administration could come and flip everything. And so I think, yeah, there's a really strong mandate from communities and from frontline peoples to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And for Indigenous peoples, that's not just a matter of carbon emissions reduction or fossil fuel infrastructure, processing fossil fuel infrastructure, but it's a matter of cultural survival. And I think for some reason, non-Indigenous folks, like many communities, that aren't frontline communities, haven't had that click in their minds that actually this conversation around averting the climate crisis, around stopping the building of new fossil fuel infrastructure, that is a matter of cultural survival for all of us, not just Indigenous peoples and frontline communities. And so I think, yeah, with this new administration, like, there's a lot of great people that I know, that I trust, that are going to be, you know, have the ear of the administration and who are helping inform a lot of these decisions and the climate plans going forward. And at the same time, it's like, there, I have just seen a very consistent track record of failure to follow through and to, you know, really take the side of communities and the front lines and of the people over just this culture in the United States of politics that is wrought with corporate influence, with corporate dollars that influence, you know, every decision at every level of power. And if it's not, you know, directly Biden that's failing us, it's the infrastructure around it and other, you know, more conservative elected officials and politicians that will, as Ibrahim said, water down, you know, and stall and halt any semblance of progress. And it's like, there's just not time, you know? And so I feel, not as optimistic, I think, as other folks do about this administration, but I'm hoping that I'm wrong, honestly. But I think, as we saw last year, you know, conversations that transformed not only social spaces, but political spaces, that came from social movements and from people on the grounds. I think the movement for Black Lives and the uprisings that happened over the last summer, transforming police abolition and defunding the police, that was something that wasn't being talked about kind of at the scale that it is now being considered, not just as like a radical call from, you know, on the grounds activists, but as a potential political alternative to the policing of Black and brown and communities. And that was because of people power. That was because of the mobilization of folks in the streets, obviously in response to generations of violence against Black bodies, against Black community and people. And so I think that's what I kind of look to when I think of a hopeful alternative to kind of this political shit show that I've seen since I was a little kid, like looking at the Obama administration, having so much hope, you know, that would be the moment in which we saw a transition away from fossil fuels, where the climate crisis would be taken seriously. Like, and again, I was a kid then, so I didn't really understand how complex and how, I don't know, everything was. But now I think where I look to for hope is at social movements and at people and at organizing to create the political will to transform this country. And I think, yeah, it'll be up to that. And I think we will see more of that. And as we can see the injustice, the violence in the streets, the police, you know, murdering innocent Black folks like that, there's no end to that in sight without completely overhauling our values and so many of these practices that we uphold, that these governments uphold, these policies allow to continue to happen. So it's a very, you know, I think it's an interrelated conversation with the climate. And I think we can look to that also with how much power there is in communities mobilizing to demand for alternative realities.
Very well said. Thank you so much to all of my fellow panelists. We're going to turn it over to Isaac for Q&A from our audience.
Sure. We'll see how many we can get to. We'll make sure that everybody sees the questions for those that we don't get to. We have one here about what can the ASBC, SBC communities of business leaders, impact investors, and capacity builders do to shift power to BIPOC communities so we can be more efficient in coming up with solutions for climate chaos. I like that. And I know that you've all tapped on a little bit of that, but anything more that you could add to what more can be done to shift power is the question.
I mean, I personally don't like these laws that are designed to quote unquote protect the non-wealthy from participating in the economy. It's like this notion that if somebody isn't already wealthy, they have no ability to decide for themselves where they want, what little capital they have to get to work. So I'm not sure what the program is that Donnell is referring to that somehow allows the communities of color to participate in the green economy, in the low carbon future. But I love that idea. You know, I really want, there's every time there's a technology inflection point, so much wealth is created, whether the transition from landline to mobile, whether it's, you know, obviously digital media compared to paper media, et cetera, so much wealth gets created. And this is our chance. This is the next big inflection point with the green economy. And we're talking about 30 years of growth. It's probably the biggest investment opportunity in human history. If there is a way to use that and to democratize it in such a way that, you know, communities that have been traditionally left out of the wealth generation engine of, you know, this, whatever this version of capitalism that we're practicing, you know, upgrade that, of course, because it's been practiced very poorly, but have it be so much more inclusionary. So Donnell, if you can educate us as to what those tools are, so we also can start incorporating them into the work that we're doing, because believe me, just like everybody else, I am not happy just making the same old investors more and more money, you know, and have the wealth divide continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which has obviously its own massive social instability problems and, you know, just simple injustice. So if you can educate us, that would be helpful, because we will take action in incorporating that into the financial instruments that we make available in our funds as well.
Yeah, I mean, we got a call from our community leaders in the Bronx, you know, pastors and rabbis and imams up in the Bronx. The Bronx has the poorest congressional district in the country. It has the highest asthma rates in the country. And when the pandemic hit, it was awful in the Bronx because the asthma rates are so high as a comorbidity that the death rate was just sky high in the Bronx and in Queens and in Brooklyn where I grew up. And the community leaders got on a conference call with me. This must have been last March, early April of 2020. And they were like, none of our people have internet. And I was like, well, yeah, you know, I think that there's going to be some program and they'll give you internet for $10 a month and, you know, maybe you can get some philanthropists to pay. Well, I'll make some calls. And they're like, no. Like, we literally don't have broadband. So even if we had the money to pay for the internet so that kids could learn remotely or people could work remotely or file for unemployment, telemedicine for seniors, even if we had the money from a philanthropist to pay, like, we literally don't have broadband connectivity in the Bronx because the telecom companies are like, we don't want to spend $2 billion running broadband up to the Bronx because those communities are too poor to pay the $100 a month apiece that we need to make money off of that infrastructure investment. And I was embarrassed because I was a community organizer for 15 years and I pride myself on knowing what's going on in communities of color, particularly in my home city of New York. But I didn't know that 27% of New York City residents in the greatest city in the world don't have broadband connectivity. So even if they do have money to pay extremely expensive rates to the telecom providers, there literally isn't the broadband available for them to do that. So What we came up with was a community-owned co-op. We formed a co-op, a coalition of teachers, principals at the local schools, pastors, imams, and rabbis, and priests, and the electricians union. So we formed a new corporation, and all of those community institutions own stock in that holding company. We invested $1 million in buying equipment and installing it on antenna, Wi-Fi antenna, on the rooftops of the schools and churches across the community. And now those community institutions own $1 million digital asset that they will all grow and develop together throughout this pandemic to provide low-cost internet, but also to provide internet for perpetuity. And that is an economic asset and a community asset that is controlled and owned by them. And so the Biden team has announced that they're going to invest $100 billion according to that same strategy. And my contention is that for clean energy and saving the planet, we must do the same thing. We must operate according to similar models, because if we don't have frontline communities and Black and brown and low-income white communities embracing clean technologies, there's no pathway for us to reduce fossil fuels at the scale that we need to in order to preserve a livable planet for our children. So if you give people an ownership share in the new technology that's being created and distributed, I believe that that's going to be a great path forward. And I'm really excited that the Biden team agrees.
I'm going to reach out to you and understand that structure better. I can't tell if it's a Reggae Plus structure or whatnot, you know, because what just happened? Anyway, I'll reach out to you separately, but thank you.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'm happy to talk. I love talking about this. I'm blue in the face.
That's actually what I reached out to you through a mutual friend to talk about, because it was the idea of turning, most people don't know this, but it's important that we understand obviously heavy industry has been traditionally moved to poor communities all around U.S. cities. And, you know, the asthma rates are through the roof and everything that Donnell mentioned compared to the wealthier parts of town. So as technology makes these polluting industries obsolete, those areas are going to become more and more desirable. And we want to prevent, gentrification again, unless those communities actually own their real estate and can benefit from the wealth generation engine of real estate appreciation, or else their rents are going to go up. They're going to have to move. And we go through the same cycle over and over and over again. While the intention is good to clean up the world, we're also, creating another problem. So if there's an engine to make sure that those communities can own the properties that they're living in, that would be again, part of that solution that is looking at the whole, not just, fixing problems in silos.
So I think that this has been such a good discussion. The chat side is blowing up. There's tons of Q&A that we still haven't gotten to, but I know that we're at time. So in about 30 seconds or less, I'd love it if each of my panelists could leave some parting thoughts, calls to action with this community. So again, SVC and ASBC. ASBC is made up of policymakers, business leaders, and impact investors. If you have any last thoughts for this community, we'd love for you to share them.
Anyone want to go first?
Please go ahead.
Gosh, parting thoughts. A lot of people may not like this, but parting thoughts is action. There's nothing else but action. It looks like this, the time to sit on soapbox and go, we should do this, we should do that, they should say this, they should do that. There's no time. I mean, yes, upgrade culture. Yes, talk. Yes, but action is what's going to change things. We are facing an existential problem. It's not going to go away because some people in North America on the coast decide to live a better, more responsible existence. The world is made of 8 billion people, and half of those people, for the first time in history, are part of the middle class and the consumer and joining the ranks of consumerism. So, and you know, like, we does not include Malaysia, Indonesia, China, India, the entire Middle East, the entire continent of Africa. When we say we should do this, they're not going to listen to us on the coasts of the United States. Saying what the right thing to do is. You know, we need to think a lot more holistically and stop looking at our belly buttons, thinking that we represent the world. We don't represent the world. We need solutions that are global, and we need to have a narrative that is global, and we need to start taking action and stop talking about taking action. Because there's three types of people in the world that I've seen in this social conscious world. There are people who are making a difference. There are people who are pretending to themselves that are making a difference. And then there's the third part, who are just people who want to be known as people who are making a difference. The latter two are unhelpful. So action is what's going to make a difference. Everything else is just an exercise in trying to feel good. And we're out of time for that.
Donnell, would you like to go next?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. I think any time that we can spend time talking as fellow travelers who are serious about, mitigating climate change, it 100% starts with keeping fossil fuels in the ground. Please reach out to us if there's anything that we can do to support any of your work. We are moving buildings off of fossil fuels in low-income communities. That's what we're about. If you want to learn more, check us out on the website, give us thoughts and feedback or projects that need financing in low-income communities, because that's what we do. So thank you.
And I would just say to contribute, no, I appreciate this conversation. Land back. I think that's also just such an important kind of political alternative to what we see around us right now. I think this year we're going to continue to see that as a call to action, a rallying cry, the return of lands to indigenous stewardship. I think is just a critical pillar in our response to the climate crisis. Find out how you can contribute to that, how you can return land, how you can invest in indigenous communities, reclaiming, what's traditionally, and I think that's inherently woven into reparations for our Black kin as well. I think, these frameworks of liberation, I think, are so interconnected. And what we saw last year as well is Black liberation movements contribute to all of our liberations in such a critical way. And for Indigenous peoples, we understand that our liberation is bound to one another. And I think that we will continue to organize from that place. And I think the climate crisis is no better example of something that is an umbrella to so many issues that affect all communities and all peoples in different ways. But tap in, get involved, and looking forward to building an alternative future we all.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us for today's important discussion on climate and justice. And a special thank you to our wonderful speakers for joining us on today's episode of the Just and Sustainable Economy podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review. ASBN's vision is a sustainable economy that is stakeholder-driven, regenerative, just, and prosperous. Visit us at asbnetwork.org and consider joining the movement. I'm Isaac Graves. Thanks for listening.